morning and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Since we have a packed room, I'm going to provide an update what we're going to be doing today. First up, we're going to hear the Senate Bill 1032, Bisphenol A, and second, we're going to hear Senate Bill 1060. Because we have a lot of people that want to testify, we are going to limit testimony because this is the time that we have. Unfortunately, we could run over, but people have other committees to get to. So I just want to let folks know that 1032 will be up first, and we don't have a lot of people. We have one page. Do we have another page? So I think we can get through those pretty quickly. We do have a timer up here, so we're going to ask people to limit their comments to 2 minutes. If you have written testimony, our trustee committee staff will take that from you and hand it out to the committee members. And please do not read your testimony because we're very capable of reading it, but you can help us by summarizing and giving us the key points. Okay. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1032. Beth, if you can give us an overview, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1032 would prohibit the manufacture, distribution, or sale of any liquid or food in a commercially available container made or lined with bisphenol A, otherwise known as BPA. It would also prohibit the manufacture, distribution, or sale of any commercially available container made or lined with BPA if the container is designed to be filled with any liquid or food intended primarily for the consumption by a child under the age of 3. It makes violations of the law an unlawful trade practice.
Okay, so Steve Henches, and I'm sorry, but I can't read your handwriting that well, so I hope that's close. Bill Hoyle, Marty Muntford. And you'll have 2 minutes each. We do have a timer. We will be sticking to that so that we can make sure and hear everybody today. And just please, just a reminder, you are being recorded, so there are people listening that cannot see you, so please do state your name, and it's also for the record. So why don't you go ahead? All three together.
Okay.
And your time is going to start right now.
For the record, I must say that's not my handwriting, because if it were mine, you wouldn't be able to read it at all. So thank you, Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Steve Henches with the American Chemistry Council, and I've been involved with the science on BPA for about 10 years now. And, of course, there's a lot of it. I'm not going to talk about that in 2 minutes. You probably remember that I was here a couple weeks ago, and I don't want to repeat all of that either. So I think in my short time, what I want to focus on is really what's new. And just after I was here, just a few days after I was here, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced their conclusions, or at least their interim conclusions, from their ongoing review of BPA. And you probably remember that their previous views and conclusions are consistent with the views of the many government bodies worldwide that have looked at the science on BPA. And there is a consensus around the world from these many government bodies that BPA is not a risk to human health, including infants and children, in particular at the very low levels of BPA that are present in some consumer products. And although it's been commonly stated that FDA reversed their position on BPA, they didn't. And in my short time, what I want to do maybe is just mention a couple of brief quotes that I think very well capture FDA's position, their current position. The first is actually from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is FDA's parent organization. The announcement a couple weeks back was really jointly from HHS, FDA, and a couple of other federal agencies. And what HHS said was, quote, BPA is not proven to harm children or adults. And perhaps even more clearly from FDA, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, who is basically the second in command at FDA, he stated, if we thought it was unsafe, it being BPA, if we thought it was unsafe, we would be taking strong regulatory action. And in fact, FDA is not taking regulatory action on BPA. Essentially, what they've done is they've reaffirmed what they've said before about the safety of BPA. And so their overall views are really consistent with what they reported back in the fall of 2008 when they released a draft report. So what are they doing? It's not that they're doing nothing. They're not taking regulatory action. That's not warranted by the science, but they are doing a few things. They did note that there are some studies that raise some questions, and as part of this discussion, they acknowledge the conclusion from the National Toxicology Program, also going back about 1.5 years. And you might remember that at that time, NTP stated that they have, quote, some concern about BPA. And both FDA and NTP have previously stated that research is needed to answer key questions and clarify uncertainties. That's really what NTP meant by some concern, that more research is needed. They acknowledge that we need to know more, and And we agree with that. We ourselves continue to sponsor research on BPA for the same purpose, to answer key questions and clarify uncertainties. Also important to know that FDA and HHS did not recommend avoiding products made from polycarbonate plastic. And in fact, Dr. Sharfstein was also quoted saying, quote, the FDA does support the use of baby bottles with BPA. So that, again, is consistent with FDA's past positions. So they haven't changed their position. What they have done, I think, is more explicitly stated what their view is, maybe with more nuance than they did before. They also explicitly recommended that families not change from their current use of infant formula or baby food. And the reason for this is that sound nutrition outweighs any potential risk from BPA. So overall, I think their conclusions are about the same as where they were a couple of years ago. There is more research underway. Actually, FDA's had research underway over the past year now, and that'll be continuing to play out over the next 1 to 2 years. Where am I in the 2 minutes?
You're up. Okay. And before we go to the next, thank you very much for being here today. And before we go to the next witness, I just, because you had testified during the interim committee and had, I'm pretty sure I recall because I checked my notes, said that no other government had banned this. And I just wanted to read into the record, because I've been having some communications with the Canadian government, that the prohibition of polycarbonate baby bottles that contain bisphenol A is not yet in place. The government of Canada is proceeding with final regulation. Once this regulation is published in Canada Gazette Part 2, which is expected in the near future, it will become law. Under the Hazardous Products Act, these products will be prohibited from advertisement, sale, and importation into Canada. So I think you are technically correct, but Canada, it sounds like as soon as they adopt these regulations, it will be banned in Canada.
That's correct. It has been proposed. It's in process. And I think it was proposed actually about 2 years ago. So I think that's also particularly telling, that proposing something 2 years ago and still not having completed that or implemented it would indicate that this isn't a particularly urgent issue in Canada.
Well, we also know that regulations take a long time, unfortunately, to promulgate at times. But anyway, I don't want to cut into your time, so why don't you go ahead, the next witness. And it's Ms. Mountford?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi. My name is Marty Mountford. I'm Executive Vice President of the International Formula Council. We're an association of manufacturers of formulated nutrition products like infant formulas and adult nutritionals. Our members are based predominantly in North America. Thank you for letting me speak today. The IFC respectfully opposes this bill, which would prohibit the manufacturing, distributing, and offering for sale in Oregon of certain products whose containers contain BPA. The currently available scientific evidence does not support this prohibition. Liquid infant formulas in metal cans have been found to contain trace levels of BPA, and powder infant formula containers may have even lower levels of BPA. However, these levels are below anything that regulatory and health authorities consider a health risk. Senate Bill 1032 would reduce the availability of infant formula products for thousands of Oregon families who safely feed their babies infant formula. And this includes the 50% of Oregon babies who receive infant formula through the USDA Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, commonly known as WIC. At any given time, about a third of all Oregon infants are...
They heard you.
Probably heard formula. One-third of all Oregon infants and about a half of the babies and young children in rural areas receive assistance from WIC. Currently, the cost of this program in Oregon is about $70 million. If this bill passes, it would significantly impact the availability of liquid and powder infant formula, and it would mean that only a limited number of liquid ready-to-feed products would be provided through WIC. Unfortunately, this form of the product is significantly more expensive, and all infant formulas are not currently available in this form, so you'd have a much smaller selection available.
Okay. Can you wrap that?
Yeah.
Thanks.
This also has a higher carbon footprint because it's more expensive to transport. And I have, many of my comments are similar to what Steve has just said, so I will not... I'll not repeat them for the benefit of the panel.
Great.
Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much, Senator.
Why don't we go ahead, and then we'll see if there's other questions at the end.
Hi, my name is Dr. William C. Hoyle, and I'm here on behalf of NAMPA, the North American Metal Packaging Alliance. And what I'd like to do is follow up a little bit. I've already supplied written comments previously and today, so the sum total of those. But to follow up on what Mari just said, it's not only just that there's limited availability of the infant formula in the ready-to-feed, there are a number of what I'll call the micronutritional, the special formulas for special infants that are not available, period, in the ready-to-feed. And so those would be totally not available. That would have to go away. The other part is and I view that as one of the many, what I'll call, unintended consequences of this regulation. I urge the committee to consider all the relevant hazard information, including those, what I refer to as unintended consequences of some of these products just no longer being available because of a ban on epoxies. Epoxies and the use of epoxies in the packaging, both metal and paper, involve provide real, important, and measurable health benefits. Even as I'm flying out here yesterday, there's another high bacterial count in fresh food because of the way they're stored and the way they're moved. The epoxies are what I would refer to as an enabling technology. They have enabled the high temperature sterilization of both the product and the food. The food is actually cooked inside the can in a hermetically sealed environment and therefore is microbiologically sound. I think that's a very, very important thing, especially when you're dealing with the number of food products that are out there. The other part is it's not, when we're talking about epoxies, it's not just one. There are approximately in North America 17,000 specifications involving epoxy coatings. Replacing those in the time period you're talking about here is just impractical, if not impossible.
Thank you.
I'll leave it at that. I know my time is short, and leave it for questions.
Unfortunately, we have a lot of people that want to speak on this bill today. Any questions for the panel? Okay, Senators? Okay. I do have a question for Ms. Mountford. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Okay. And is Similac part of your group that you represent?
Yes,
it is. Okay. Because the question I have, I pulled this up off the Internet that is dated July 9th, 2009, and it says that Abbott's Similac brand formulas have proven to be safe and effective, and that in response to mothers seeking BPA-free products, they're pleased to share that they've now achieved BPA-free status in Similac brand powdered infant formula products. So I guess I'm just curious about why you're opposed to a ban when you're advertising about it on through a press release, and that the Similac is 91% BPA-free, and then I found that Nestle is saying they're 80% BPA-free. So if you claim you don't have alternatives, but you're advertising this as a plus, I'm a little confused.
Well, I think there's a little confusion, and it's semantics, too, because sometimes people talk about the product itself, so what's in the container, but often the bills like this one would ban a container having BPA. So In some situations, that BPA may migrate into the product more than in others. So you've got a different situation.
Okay. It isn't exactly clear from your description. But that's okay. We'll go on, and you can...
Being an analytical chemist, what it amounts to is if you analyze the product, you're not going to find BPA. Your bill doesn't deal with the product. It deals with the package and the product. If it's in the package, it's banned, whether it's in the product or not, period.
And you can usually find it if you look hard enough.
Okay. Well, my point is that I'm hearing that there aren't alternatives, that it's not a problem, yet it's being advertised that we're BPA safe. So that sort of sends conflicting messages. It's just something
I've observed. It's the way the bill is written. It would ban it whether it's in the product or not.
Okay. I don't think you're quite getting my point, but we can talk about it offline.
I've been through that in other states. It's the same thing.
Okay. I think unless there's other questions, Senator Hess.
Thank you. Is any BPA manufactured in Oregon? You said North America.
Not in the state of Oregon, no.
How about Minnesota?
In the state, no.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And I think, is Senator Bates here and wanted to testify? Okay, we'll get him up next time because I know he came in. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's up to you.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
So we're going to have Senator Bates come up so he can get to his hearings, and then we'll have a couple of folks, Catherine Thomason, Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, I can never say your name right, and Senator Alan Bates, come on up. We're just trying to move folks along, so you can come up and sit with the senator. He won't bite.
Sure?
Yeah. We've had him tested.
The way this week's going. I've had my shot.
He's been vaccinated.
Okay. He's been vaccinated. Thank you for being here today, Senator.
Okay. Thanks for having him. I don't know if I'm not just going to be repeating what other people have said, but I'll try not to. And it'll be very short. About 8, 9, 10 years ago, we started seeing reports about bisphenol A and potential endocrine effects in children. And we got more and more aware of that over the last 10 years. In the last 3 or 4 years, the evidence has become pretty straightforward that there is significant risk to children, especially under the age of 3, and that's why I'm supporting this bill. As far as adults are concerned, other parts of our population, I think the jury is still out. We won't know that for several more years. I'm also moved by the fact that when retailers like Walmart say they're moving away from this and can move away from it, then obviously, despite what I've heard other places, there are alternatives available and they're rapidly becoming available. I'm not concerned that we're going to be cutting off formula to children. I think there's other ways of doing this. Of course, I'm a big proponent of breastfeeding anyway, but for some people who can't breastfeed, formula can be an alternative they have to use. We warn people about it in our practice. We try to get people to stay away from it in our practice when they have young children, you know, especially for women who are pregnant, because it's also a danger for them because it's going to be in cord blood in the baby and potentially in the breast milk. The bottom line for me in this is a very limited bill. I think it's focused right where it needs to be focused, and that's on children under the age of 3, getting what we call sippy cups and bottle formula and bottles for formula away from those kids that are made from BPA plastic. I think it's the way to go. It's appropriate. It should be done. If anyone's had a chance to read some of the things we're seeing in young children as far as changes in the genital organs, potential changes in the thyroid, premature adolescence, is quite concerning and pretty closely linked to phenyl A now. We think we need to get this out of here and do it now. I don't believe this is going to happen if states don't take a step forward. If we don't take a step forward, we'll be delayed and delayed and delayed. I think back on the battles we've fought over the last 30 years on lead and lead paint and lead in our environment, lead in our gas. Think of the cigarette battles we fought. None of that came from the federal government. It was all settled at a local level and then forced onto the federal government as we became more and more aware of these dangers. So I'm very supportive of this bill. Thank you for bringing it forward, and I'm hoping that this committee will move in a favorable position. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the senator before he has to run off? Okay, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to go back to the two-minute rule. We let the senator have a few extra seconds there because he's more senior than me, so. All right, thank you. So, and just folks know, we don't have a little card, so Beth's just going to sort of hold it up. It's a little awkward, but we want to make sure everybody gets a chance to be heard. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Dr. Catherine Thomason, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association in support of this bill. I was asked to bring information about the endocrinologic effects of this, and I like to use a metaphor that you folks make laws, and the laws are like the genetic code. And then we have police, and we have teachers, and we have people who are very important in our society, but there aren't that many of them to help control and enforce the laws. Well, that's what hormones do. They are only needed in very tiny amounts to create an effect. And bisphenol A was used as an estrogen replacement hormone back in the 30s, so we know it has hormonal effect in tissue. And estrogen receptors are located not just on the skin for secondary sex characteristics, breast tissue, ovary, and pituitary. Estrogen receptors are in our pancreas, they're in our gut, they're in our brain, affecting the development of our behavior. So bisphenol A has effect in all of these locations. And in fact, in some circumstances, more effect the smaller the dose. So this isn't the more dose, the worse problem. Now, some of the specific things that Dr. Bates was referring to includes early puberty, early breast development, breast tissue that's more dense and abnormally formed, therefore when it's exposed to other carcinogens, it's more likely to develop cancer. We have anti-androgen effects, so it's not just the estrogen receptor that's affected. So increase in prostate size, prostate cancer, abnormalities of the development of the prostate and urethra. And then these newer things that are effects on hormones that none of us even know the words of, hormones that are created by lipid cells. And so we're seeing an increase in the lipid inability to respond to insulin. So we're seeing more insulin resistance, and we're seeing more thyroid resistance. And so when you have thyroid resistance, we worry about decrease in metabolism as well as mental retardation when it's in the fetus. So, thank you.
Great, thank you. And we'll wait and take questions after panels.
So, Chair Dinkfelder, distinguished members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, and I am the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council, OEC, and a broad coalition of medical health professionals, unions, child care advocates, child advocates, and environmental groups support this bill. They're listed on the last page of my testimony. As Dr. Thomason mentioned, BPA has been around for a long time. So why are we just hearing about these problems in recent years? Well, science, like many things in our modern society, has significantly advanced in the past 60 years. And while the original intent of BPA use for polycarbonate plastic was not meant to cause harm, our current science tells us that we should be concerned. So here's my quick reasons why I'm worried about BPA, and our coalition partners are also. It doesn't stay in the products in which it's used. It leaches into our food and drinks, including the contents of our children's baby bottles. It gets into our bodies. We know that more than 90% of Americans have detectable levels of bisphenol A in their bodies. These are studies from the Centers for Disease Control. These same studies from Centers for Disease Control and others have demonstrated that young children and lower-income people have the highest levels of BPA in their bodies. While the presence in their body isn't all that concerning until you read the studies published in the past 5 years that show that BPA is a hormone mimic. This means that it can act like and interfere with normal functioning of hormones in our bodies. Catherine mentioned the things that hormones do. My simple answer is stuff you don't want to mess with. Hormones are finely tuned, and we don't want to mess with that. And while I won't go into the details of science, BPA exposure has been linked with lots of things: behavioral changes, breast and prostate cancer, reproductive problems, including infertility, low sperm count, and miscarriages, and most recently, heart abnormalities and diabetes. And most frightening to me is that BPA can have these impacts at very low doses. Luckily, just this past January, the FDA provided some guidance on what to make of all this recent flurry of information on BPA, and I provided you with the statement from the BPA and the stuff I passed around. I have a slightly different take on what the FDA said as from what the first panel said.
Quickly.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up.
So according to the FDA's announcement, they have some concern about the potential effects of BPA on the brain, behavior, and prostate. Unfortunately, according to the FDA's own statements, which are listed on page 6 of what I gave you, they are limited in the actions they can take because of how they regulate bisphenol A. So state lawmakers need to consider that they can't rely on the FDA to regulate BPA without the tools, and we need to take action to regulate it here at the state. Responsible businesses and states are taking the lead to reduce BPA exposures. Our neighbors to the north, Washington, have just passed it out of both their chambers by overwhelming majorities, and we hope that Oregon can do the same. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Yep, Senator Hess.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I'd like to get your take on a question that was raised by the Chemistry Association, the manufacturers, which is basically if this is so bad, then why doesn't the FDA ban it?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hass. If you look at this, which I provide you on page 6, the FDA actually goes into why they can't really take any additional action. And one of the comments they make is that they would like to increase their ability to regulate products such as this. So BPA is regulated as an indirect food additive. And under the FDA current regulations, what that means is it gets a general pass. Companies don't have to tell them how they use it, where they use it, or how much of it they use it. So they really don't have any information about what they can and can't, where it is. And so they're very limited. And they even say in their statement here on their release that it would take them quite some time to work through all this. That's sufficiently.
And they are going to be spending about $30 million more to further study it over the next year or two, and have made a number of recommendations that are similar to the piece of paper I'll put over here, that doctors can't tell all their patients what to do in terms of how to avoid these plastics. But they do recommend that we not use certain kinds of plastics, certainly not use them in the microwave, certainly not wash them with detergents or in our dishwashers, which is where we want to wash our dishes, and, you know, for safety and making sure that they're sterile and that sort of thing. So they are making some of those recommendations, saying that to be on the safe side of things, you may want to alter how you act. But many, many people don't hear that.
Doctor, I'm not even sure if you have patients, but if you do, what do you tell them on this?
Well, I tell them that they should never microwave plastic, that they should never put their plastics in a dishwasher, because heat and freezing can increase the amount of chemicals that come off the plastics. I tell them to use glass. I have a handout that I'll give to all of you in terms of what the OMA has just put on their website in terms of what we want to tell patients about these kinds of products, and that there are some plastics that appear for right now to be safer than polycarbonate.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
You.
And is it Susan? We're going to call Susan Beal up, who's been very patient with her child. And while we're waiting for her, we'll have, why don't we have Craig Smith and Sean Miller? And then Susan will come join. Susan, thank you for your patience. We wanted to accommodate you so you could go back to...
Thank you for your patience.
And could you just make sure and state your name for the record?
Yes.
Yeah.
My name is Susan Beal, and let me get my daughter.
Come back.
Sean will take care of her.
Come sit with us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi.
I just want to thank you so much for the chance to be part of this hearing with my child in tow. It's just an issue that is without precedent to me. And my name is Susan Beal. This is my daughter, Pearl. She's 20 months old, and she was born in May 2008 with some eating problems that were very frustrating and hard to diagnose. And weeks in, we were weighing her every day, counting ounces in, feeding charts ruled our lives. And eventually, my hope to nurse her wasn't possible, so we moved to formula, and I can safely say that it saved her life, and I am so grateful that it exists, that it's available, and that has brought her to this place. But the frustration my husband and I have felt through this process is that as consumers, there are no options for shielding our precious, small, struggling child from a daily exposure to BPA. And if you do just a little research, as a parent, you'll drive yourself crazy. And I feel so fortunate to be where we are, but I would give anything to spare a parent 5 years from now what we've gone through and save their children the potential health risks and changes that these chemicals, known toxins, can cause. So I just would like to ask...
Babe!
Hi, baby! I would just
Does she want to say something? You've got 30 seconds left.
There are so many millions more children like Pearl, and I would just ask that our great and beautiful state of Oregon do everything in their power to protect its smallest citizens and the most vulnerable, and hopefully set a path the rest of the country will follow with us. So I just want to thank you again for the chance to speak. My husband couldn't be here, but he, like me, feels so passionately about this, and we're so grateful at the possibility of this law. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for coming here today, and thank you, Pearl, for being with us. And if you want to entertain lobbyists, we're more than happy to have you go out in the hall and do that.
Yeah.
You may do a better job at it than we do up here, so thank you. Thank you for coming here. Is there any questions so we can let her go and go home and take care of her child? I do have a question about how hard or easy was it to find BPA products available? I mean, did you have to spend a lot of time on the internet trying to locate these products?
Here's what I did do. I'll try to be brief, but every formula can we bought for a year, which was dozens and dozens and dozens, had BPA in the liners. There are no options there, but I took it out of the cans as soon as we got into the house, put it in glass jars to try to minimize the leaching, which is very, you know, disturbing. And then I used every research skill I have as a writer to find out what products were BPA-free to dispense the formula in. And it's not obvious, but, you know, the containers, to me, are less of an issue than baby food jars and formula cans, which there are very little you can do as a consumer or a parent. Does that...
Thank you.
Answer.
Very helpful.
I just want to thank you again, and thank you to everyone who I jumped ahead of in line. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Okay, great. All right. Why don't you go ahead and we'll get her up here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Craig Smith. I'm Vice President of the Northwest Food Processors Association and representing the Oregon Food Processors. I'm not going to go through the whole testimony. Basically, I really want to make a couple of points here today. Food processors have a huge stake in the safety of the products that we sell, and we won't survive if we're careless, and we certainly don't want to put anybody at harm. The BPA issue is an issue that has many it's a science issue that has really not been resolved, but it has unintended consequences when you look at the way this bill is formed. And I think it's the unintended consequences that I'd really like to talk about today, because when we politicize food safety and attempt to jump ahead of the process, which is what I believe Senate Bill 1032 does, we have some unintended consequences that we really can't predict. 1032 will effectively shut down the canned food industry in the state of Oregon. And the reason that will happen is that it basically bans, it puts us at risk. It does not define what constitutes a product that's primarily intended for children under three. It would open our industry for litigation and all kinds of tort claims, and it would basically make the canning industry, which is right on the edge of viability right now, a non-viable process. Looking for alternatives is difficult. It's a long-term process. The Food and Drug Administration is the one that does that. We are looking, but alternatives are not easy to come by. And regardless of what you've been told, they are not commercially available for almost any product category, especially high-acid foods. Consequently, companies will close under this bill, and the litigation will start as soon as the bill becomes law. But other consequences will also show up almost immediately. You have before you a letter from the Sunshine Division, the Portland Police Bureau, stating their concern over this bill. Food bank donations would be a big problem under this bill. We would no longer be able to donate. 50% of all donations to food banks come from our industry, which very quietly steps up to the plate to serve the very people you're trying to protect. So I would ask you to rethink the bill, to step back from this particular approach. We need to engage the process with the FDA and the World Food Authorities, and we need to really be thoughtful the way we move forward so there's not unintended consequences.
Thank you. Sean?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to Senate Bill 1032. And I know the FDA in their recent announcement, I think they were very clear that if there is a problem, they would ban it. And so I think we're very supportive of that particular process and want that process to move forward. I want to particularly just talk just on a few issues. Section 1, subsection 2 on the single use particular products where we have some questions, and really our questions from the store perspective, the retail perspective, since we are the final point of sale, is what products are going to be left in these categories. And we don't know that. What we're asking our manufacturers, and we really don't know what is left. And so we're trying to figure that out, especially since these products are needed by a lot of families, particularly with the Women and Infant Children Program. The other thing is where it talks about intended primary for consumption by children under three. We have some questions. Does that mean Campbell's soup? Does that mean applesauce? I know that's not the intent by the drafters, but I know Campbell's soup makes particular labels with cartoon characters as their noodles, and so does that qualify? We don't know these questions. And then the last thing I just want to touch on, Madam Chair, is just the liability from the retail point, because the manufacturer is the one that's responsible for the product itself, and we don't know necessarily what is in that liner. So when it's on the shelf and all this goes on to effect in the same date, we could have things on the shelf. We're obviously, again, the point of sale, we're going to be the ones named in the lawsuit, and we may necessarily not know if, from a distribution standpoint, what products don't have BPA and what products do. And so we're right there on the front lines and real concerned about the liability point of view when all this would go into effect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Hess? And sorry, I saw him first.
Thanks.
And then Senator Atkinson.
There have been proposals out there that would apply to focus on sippy cups and bottles and not canned food, and I'd just like to get your take on whether that would change anything you've said. If it doesn't apply to cans, I assume this doesn't just takes you out.
Well, I'm not here to throw anybody under the bus, but...
That's okay. It's done here all the time.
Probably not by me, though.
You're not the first.
But I think that the way the bill... the way the bill is approaching this is, frankly, our position is that we'd like to see the process play out. We do think that the FDA and the state food regulatory process is the right place to do this kind of thing first, and then to come to the legislature with the facts. And I think the jury's still out. But we don't have any viable alternative at this point, so it's really a moot discussion for us as to how the process works forward from here for canned foods.
Senator Atkinson?
Talk to me more a little bit more about your concerns with food banks and food donations and gospel rescue missions and that.
Sure. Senator Dinkfelder and Vice Chair Atkinson, the contingent liability of putting a product on a shelf that could potentially be litigated, because as you heard in previous testimony, there is a concern that a particular product caused a particular effect. Whether that's provable or not in any particular case, I'm not here to say. But the litigation will be rampant, and we wouldn't be able to take that chance. So the donation process would probably end almost immediately, because these products all have 2-year shelf life. And so these are going to be on the shelf, if this bill goes forward as it is, when it takes effect. So it would be a huge problem, and I think that's the nature of the issue that you're seeing raised in the letter from the Sunshine Division and other food bank people we've talked to. This is going to be a huge problem, because canned food is the basis of the food bank program. That's the stable piece that sits on the shelf that you can hang on to for a while and really manage. And then there's also the USDA portion. This bill would also put the food banks at risk, because they would be violating the law if they distributed a product that contained BPA, not just if they manufactured it or sold it. So it puts everybody in the liability loop.
Follow up?
This is for both of you. So I go to Fred Meyer and I buy a can of peas from Birdseye Peas, NORPAC product, and I donate it to a food bank. Talk me through the liability chain.
Yeah, and I just want to follow up. This is for children. This is for baby products under 3. So,
So I buy cream corn.
Yeah, okay. So may I, Chair Dinkfelder, I think your point is really important, and I appreciate so much that clarification, because the bill doesn't say it's for baby products. The bill says primarily intended for children under 3. It does not define that term. So are peas or corn or squash primarily intended for children under 3? They're certainly consumed. I have under 3-year-old grandson. He eats an enormous amount of those products. So is it primarily intended for that, or is it primarily intended for above 3? Or is applesauce a 3-year-old product, a 4-year-old product, or a 2-year-old product? The approach of this bill is it's not narrow. It's very broad, and it brings all products into the loop.
Although you heard a question about taking out the cans, so that would eliminate that concern. Yeah, and I think Senator Prezonsky has a follow-up.
I want to follow up on what Senator Hess asked, because you got off without answering it, and I'd like Sean's. If this bill was modified, if it was limited to sippy cups and to baby bottles, what would your positions then be?
Madam Chair, Senator Prezonsky, I don't know what the impact of just that particular product. I know some of those have been changed to quote-unquote BPA-free. But I know with just the science and how they've looked into those particular products, they're actually confined BPA in some of those products. So, again, I don't know the scope or the science. I'm not here to argue that.
Certainly,
so from the retail side, I don't know the impact to that question. Happy to look at whatever amendment you all are proposing, but I haven't seen that to date, just applying it to those products.
So I haven't heard.
I haven't heard a
question, and I'd like answers from all that are coming forward as to if it's narrowed, because what I heard is that right now the bill is too broad. It's undefined, and it could, in fact, be interpreted being primary for children under 3, or it could not be. But we would think, for most part, sippy cups and baby bottles would, in fact, have a more defined, end user of those products.
And one other point, this is the beauty of, you know, iPhones, where you can look up information on the Internet and virtually here. Connecticut's law is going into effect October 1st, 2011, so it has not gone into effect first. But they do ban use of BPA in reusable food or beverage containers, plastic containers or jars or cans containing infant formula or baby food. So I'm going to be very curious to see if there is no more canned food sold in Connecticut after that because of this law.
Mm-hmm.
You have any comments on that?
I haven't read the Connecticut law.
Madam Chair, I have. I think the retailers have the same question. They just don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's just the biggest issue we have. We don't know.
Okay. I think there's a bit of speculation about we won't be able to get any food products anymore if this bill passes. But appreciate your point. Thank you for being here
today.
Thank
you so much.
Okay. Thank you. We have Karen Elliott, who's also been very patient. Is Karen outside? Oh, Karen. Yes, I got a note that you need to go. So we will get you up. Also, Reagan Gray and Janice O'Malley, and I think we just have a few folks after that. If you can come up, if your name's been called, please. Thank you for being here, Ms. Elliott.
Thank you. Senator Dinkfelder and committee, my name is Karen Elliott. I'm here to speak in favor of 1032. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm representing Oregon Nurses Association, and I've worked a majority of my career in the maternal child health field. As nurses, we recognize from independent research that bisphenol A can cause health risks. You need to know that nurses and the rest of the healthcare community, including American Nurses Association, is unified behind banning BPA in products targeted for our most vulnerable population, infants and young children. Infants are not just small adults. Their bodies are even more sensitive to toxic chemicals. Infant endocrine systems exchange messages with the brain, directing growth and development. BPA disrupts this communication because it's, as you've heard, an endocrine disruptor, setting the stage for health problems later in life. And you've heard quotes about, from the science, what kind of health problems could result. I think that we all know that, you know, actual brain development early in life is one of the very important things. You've heard of science on that too, so it could disrupt that. New mothers need to learn a vast amount of information when they become a mother for the first time. They shouldn't be, have to worry about endocrine disruptors in the very products that are supposed to nurture their child, their food. We know that breastfeeding is best and the least risk to exposing an infant to BPA. However, many breastfeeding mothers go back to work and need to pump breast milk and eventually will use that equipment which have BPA in it or bottles, and so the risk is still there for them. My first grandbaby was born just 2 weeks ago. Such a delight.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My daughter-in-law is a school psychologist. She shopped for BPA-free products because she's well-read, she's educated. But, you know, not every mother is as well-read or as astute, or in poor women don't have as much access to this kind of information. And so we can just remove that risk for them by banning BPA. Please ban BPA from these products.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Janice. And while we're waiting, I'll call up, because we only have a few folks left, Todd Wynn. Is Todd here? Come on up. Okay, Janice, go ahead.
Hi, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Janice O'Malley, and I represent AFSCME Council 75 and the employees who have endorsed this bill, the Department of Environmental Quality, Metro, Multnomah County, and licensed in-home family child care providers in the state. I actually wanted to take a personal sort of side note, and as a neurotic first-time mother, I did some research on the formula canister that I used to feed my son after I stopped breastfeeding at 7 months. And I found out that the formula canister was lined with BPA after emailing the company. And I immediately felt betrayed. I felt helpless. and realized after doing more research on trying to find other suitable containers or other formulas that did not contain BPA, that it was pretty difficult to find, which I found shocking considering that BPA has been, for the most part, removed from a lot of bottles and sippy cups. No. And I find the argument that if FDA knows that the that BPA is harmful and they would ban these products from the country, doesn't hold water, because I think cigarettes contain nicotine, and despite the proven health risks of nicotine, the FDA has not banned cigarettes. There are proven scientific studies, over 200 of them, that show the adverse effects, and arguments to the contrary, I think, are completely irresponsible. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 1032, and I urge you to make sure that formula canisters remain on the bill as being banned from being sold.
Thank you. Okay, Todd?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am a policy analyst with Cascade Policy Institute. Cascade Policy Institute, in collaboration with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, has released an extensive report about the negligible risks and also the benefits of BPA use. And I've made that report available to you today. Now, the report clarifies why lawmakers should be wary of anti-BPA proposals. BPA has a 50-year safe record use and is one of the most extensively studied chemicals on Earth. Consumers, including children, are exposed to BPA at levels that are 100 to 1,000 times lower than EPA's estimated safe exposure levels. And less tested and inferior alternatives will carry a higher risk for consumers and children and will likely come at higher prices as well. Now, the Food and Drug Administration recently expressed some concern relating to some studies indicating that BPA is weakly estrogenic in rodents. But unlike rodents, humans metabolize and pass BPA quickly, limiting these endocrine effects. And in any case, the simple fact that a substance is considered weakly estrogenic is no reason to ban it. If that was true, then we should also ban soy, peas, and a number of other healthy food products. Now, according to a National Academy of Sciences study, exposure to natural phytoestrogens is up to 100,000 to a million times higher than exposure to estrogen-mimicking substances found in BPA. So that appears that BPA is actually less dangerous than soy milk. Scientific panels such as the European Union Risk Assessment, National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology in Japan, and also Health Canada, and many, many others around the world have reviewed and continue to review the evidence and the complete body of evidence on BPA and report no serious concerns with BPA. Despite considerable fears raised by activist groups and the press, the science does not warrant regulations on BPA. Instead, it shows that human exposure is too low to have any measurable impact. As a result, regulatory measures such as Senate Bill 1032 to ban or limit BPA use simply promised to raise prices for consumers and could have unintended and adverse health consequences. So I urge you to vote no on this bill.
Perfect timing. Thank you. All right, any questions for any of these panelists? All right, thank you very much for coming here today. We have a couple folks left, Tim Daugherty and Andy Harris. Betsy, who is? Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll have to have one more panel then. And Betsy Earls, I don't think I called Betsy up already. Betsy, did you come up already?
No.
Okay. 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 Why don't you get whoever wants to get started?
Thank you very much. I'm Tim Daugherty. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Bottled Water Association, and we oppose the Senate bill. Things that I've heard today still concern me, that we've heard testimony that that there really is no evidence by FDA that it does have an effect on children, and that is one thing that we still want to say as an association. We're a group of bottlers in the Northwest that primarily bottle 5-gallon water, like the one that you have here behind you. This bill we take our direction from the FDA. All of our bottlers test their products. They get the materials used in home and office delivery are all have to be regulated and tested. And at this point, we have found nothing to say that we should not continue doing this as normal. Okay. One of the concerns that we have, although it does not state, this bill does not state 5-gallon water, we are concerned how we distinguish who would drink from a water cooler. As you are drinking from a water cooler today, if it's a if it's a child or an adult. This product, again, is very safe for us. So the way we wash and maintain it is very, very important. One of the things that, if this bill passes, we're concerned that it's going to have a very negative effect on our industry because we're going to get thrown into this category of that polycarbonate bottles with BPA are unsafe. And at this point, the alternative to that would be businesses closing, going out of business, a lot of unemployment for companies. We're really concerned about where we'd go with that. One of the things as an association that we do, we heard people today talk about donating water and product. We've donated 5-gallon bottles have gone to Haiti to take care of this terrible earthquake that we've had. And these are things that we're concerned. Can we continue to do things like this in the future? But again, I wanted to say that we are against this bill. We are waiting for FDA to continue for additional findings, but we take our regulation from FDA.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Frank? You're not Mr. Frank.
Harris,
sorry. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair,
sorry about that.
The committee. I'm Dr. Andy Harris. I'm a physician here in Salem. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Center for Christian Values in support of Senate Bill 1032. Oregon Center for Christian Values is a nonpartisan, non-denominational organization. We concentrate our efforts on issues of poverty, health care, and environmental stewardship. We especially speak out for the health care for the poor, the medically uninsured, and the most vulnerable and marginalized members of our society. Bisphenol A is a ubiquitous toxic chemical which disproportionately affects the most vulnerable among us, who of course are our children. 3 weeks ago, the FDA reported that, and I quote here, both the National Toxicology Program at the National Institutes of Health and the FBA have some concern about the potential effects of BPA on brain behavior and prostate gland in fetuses, infants, and young children. So the chemical can leach into food, as we've heard today, and a study of more than 2,000 people found that over 90% of them have BPA in their urine. Traces have also been found in breast milk, in mother's blood, and in the umbilical cord blood. A great number of studies, over 200 of independent studies, have linked BPA exposures to numerous health problems, including cancer, obesity, and reproductive issues. There's a lot of new research that's come out in the last 6 months to a year that links BPA to sexual dysfunction and lower sperm counts, miscarriages, et cetera, et cetera. Dr. Linda Birnbaum, the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, says FDA research on BPA will involve potential effects on behavior, obesity, diabetes, reproductive disorders, cancer, asthma, heart disease, and effects that could be carried over from one generation to another. So these organizations, the NIH and FDA, are concerned and are continuing to study this. So the Oregon Center for Christian Values believes in the biblical imperative that our bodies are holy temples created by God in God's own image and should not be desecrated by toxic chemicals or in other ways. In sum, I would urge the Oregon legislature to act responsibly to pass Senate Bill 1032 for the health of our children.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. Questions?
Tim,
Senator Prasansky.
What happened to the glass carboys?
Well, glass carboys have not been used primarily just because of how unsafe they are to transport and for the liability, I suppose, but if they were dropped and broken, there could be some severe injury. So that's really the main reason is for the durability of a 5-gallon polycarbonate bottle, the reusability of it. It makes approximately 50 trips before it's put into recycling and then used for other products. And again, one of the things I wanted to say earlier that I didn't get a chance is that not only does the water industry use polycarbonate, but we now have that. We test for bisphenol A in our water tests, and all of the bottlers that are regulated by the International Bottled Water Association are finding absolutely no BPA in our water product at all.
And I just want to clarify that the bill does not ban water bottles.
Right. Our main concern is just really what the general public will think, because we don't at this time have an alternative source. So it could be a real negative effect. They're already finding a negative effect just from the publicity of come up and pick up the water cooler and the bottles because it's unsafe because of what they're reading and of the controversial what we're seeing right now.
So can I ask you, there are many baby bottle manufacturers that are using non-BPA in their plastics. Can that not be used in a water bottle?
Water bottles
because
can...
Because I know Nalgene and there's Camelback and there's several folks that are now manufacturing those bottles without BPA.
And there is other products. PET has been tested. One of our biggest concerns right now is that the availability, the ability of it to actually to hold up during transport and not leak and cause problems. So there is testing of other products. But today, this is the product that's the safest.
Okay. But I just want to be clear, for this bill, it's not included in this bill.
And I do want to say that we totally realize that, but we are concerned because we have nowhere else to go if for a different bottle in today's market.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Hass.
Why would you have to go somewhere else?
Well, if this bill passed and we were to say that children under 3 years old, how can we regulate a child under 3 years old from drinking from that cooler? The way I read the bill is that would actually ban a child under 3 years old from drinking out of a water cooler. And in today's market, that's why many, many people get water coolers in their homes,
yes,
is to have a good, pure drinking water source for their children.
And I just want to put on the record that the bill actually says liquid intended primarily for consumption by a child. So I would say that probably that's not what the intent of this legislation is when we're saying primarily for a child. Okay. So I just want to put that on the record.
Okay.
So we have a couple of folks who want to testify left. Thank you both, gentlemen. We have Betsy Earls, who we're still searching for. She seems lost in the bowels of the Capitol. Okay, so our last panel is Lisa Frank, Reagan Gray, and Melina Carabajal. Am I saying that right? Hi, Reagan.
Hi.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Well, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Reagan Gray. I'm the Policy Director for Children First for Oregon, and I'd like to express our support for Senate Bill 1032. Children First believes that all children deserve a healthy start in life, and Senate Bill 1032 will protect children from the toxic chemical of BPA in their food and beverage containers, allowing them to grow up to healthy and realize their full potential. Children are our most vulnerable citizens to toxic chemicals, but current laws don't adequately protect them. And because children's bodies are growing and developing, they're more vulnerable to the effects of toxic chemicals than adults. Even small amounts of a chemical can impact a child's ability to reach his or her full potential. And the current safety regulations for food and beverage containers designed for children inadequately address the presence of chemicals linked to harmful health and developmental effects for children. So currently, there's little or no government oversight of these toxic chemicals and in the consumer products, especially children's products. And Senate Bill 1032 seeks to correct this current regulatory loophole. And we want to ensure that every child in Oregon has the opportunity to develop into a happy, healthy adult and give back to the state of Oregon. So that's why we're supporting this bill.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Frank?
Thank you for the opportunity to testify to show my strong support for Senate Bill 1032. I'm thrilled that my state is stepping up to the plate with some others to protect these children from this toxic chemical. My name is Lisa Frack. I'm an Oregonian and a parent of two kids under seven, both of them native Oregonians. Coleman is now seven. George is three. They were most certainly born with BPA in their bodies and further contaminated in their earliest years by drinking from polycarbonate bottles and sippy cups and eating canned foods that I fed them. And I'm aware canned foods are not included in this bill. Our toxic laws have failed them and failed me as a parent. My highest priority is their health and their safety, and that's what brings me here today. As
yeah.
no doubt
can you just pull the mic towards you? Because
we want to make sure,
we want to make sure you're on the record and folks behind you can hear.
As you've no doubt heard today leading up to this day, the science around BPA is more solid, literally, I think, every day. We all know it's in us. There's no question about that anymore. And while some, amazingly to me, continue to question its health effects, they must not be looking at the mounting scientific evidence. I'm hardly alone in feeling frustrated that my kids continue to be guinea pigs while the government and industry duke it out and do more studies. $30 million worth, I heard earlier, at the federal level. We don't need more studies. We need more common sense health. We need common sense health protective policies that put my children and all of Oregon's children first. In the meantime, we parents are left holding the bag. In January, as was also discussed earlier, the U.S. FDA concluded that it had, quote, some concern, its third level of concern, about BPA, and it actually advised parents and has a whole webpage on telling us how to avoid it. It's a lot to remember. If you have an iPhone in the aisle, that's handy, but most of us don't or can't use it because our kids are in the cart. And as you might imagine, identifying what does and doesn't contain BPA is no easy feat, even if you know about it and you're trying really, really hard to avoid it, especially when you're in the grocery store aisle with two kids in the cart. I want to buy food and drinks for my kids without wondering if the container it comes in is toxic. And I bet retailers in Oregon and elsewhere would be thrilled if we would stop asking them questions and would start buying what's on their shelves again, honestly, instead of shopping online in Kansas to buy BPA-free products, which is honestly what a bunch of my friends do because we trust that store. And especially in this economic comic, I think the businesses need our trust because they need our business. And one thing that I found rather shocking about the FDA is that they assigned the very same level of concern to fetal exposure to amphetamines as they did to BPA. They've got five levels. The third level is some concern. BPA? Amphetamines.
So we have your testimony. I'm apologizing and have to have you wrap up because we're out of time.
Oh, no problem. I would just say something I wanted to share in closing was last night I mentioned to a friend, and I thought her quote was worth repeating. I told her I'd be here today, and she said, this is her quote, "I knew BPA was bad a long time ago, but my husband kept telling me, kept saying, if it were, the government would protect us. And what I would say is it is bad, and the government hasn't protected us, and I'm here to ask you to change that by passing this bill. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Earls, we found you.
Sorry.
Okay, you've got 2 minutes, and then we're closing down this hearing.
Okay, I don't think I'm going to take that long.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the AOI Retail Council. The Retail Council has several hundred members across the state and country participating in the Oregon business community and in others. Oregon retailers, as I'm sure you've heard already, sell thousands and thousands of products that are made or packaged with BPA. Some of these products can be made with alternative compounds, but many cannot. We are particularly concerned with three aspects of the bill that's before you. First, we're concerned about the implications for food safety and availability. As we've heard, epoxy resins made with BPA are, in many cases, critical to ensuring that food or formula are safe from dangerous bacteria. Banning the sale of food packaged with BPA would dramatically reduce the availability of certain categories of food. Second, the bill has areas that are extremely vague and not specific enough, and our particular concern, I think, has already been articulated. It doesn't define what is meant by something that's primarily intended for children under 3 years of age. I'm sure you've heard that already, but I'm concerned about that, not only with regard to food, but with regard to reusable products for eating or drinking with children. And the third concern that we have about this bill is that it does not address the potential liability for retailers who are selling products that may or may not have BPA in them. In many cases, we are not aware and not told by our manufacturers, even when we ask, whether a product has BPA in its packaging or within it. And if the bill goes into effect all at once when we have products on our shelves that we don't know whether they contain BPA or not, we'll have liability that is obviously concerned.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for any of this panel? Okay. Thank you. And we have something that Beth needs to read into the record.
Madam Chair, there are two letters that were submitted, one from the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the Confederated Tribes, and another from the Yellow Hawk Tribal Health Center. You should have those in front of you.
Okay. And also there was a letter from the City of Portland.
There
is that correct?
There was also, yes.
Okay. So with that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? And so with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1032. I'm going to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 1060, and I just wanted to, as soon as the room clears out, because there's going to be some people leaving, so we ask you to do that and be quiet, please, when you're leaving, because we're going into the next hearing. For those of you who are here to testify on Senate Bill 1060, we're going to have a couple panels come up and introduce it. We will stay late. Again, we're going to go 2 minutes for everybody who's signed up, but we want to make sure that folks that came here, especially that came far away, will get heard first. So I just want to make that clear. So with that, as soon as I get my trusty staff back, we're going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1060. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Members and Chair, you should have in front of you Senate Bill 1060-1 as well as Senate Bill 1060-2. The SMS that's in front of you is on the -1 amendment. This amendment would authorize the use of Class 1 waterways for public use between the lines of ordinary high water, with some exceptions that are specified in the bill. There are a number of other provisions, but I think you're going to be having a lot of testimony on what those are, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you, and I see that the folks who are coming in can come right up to the panel here. Secretary of State Kate Brown.
We actually got some panels.
Okay, so whoever is, come on up because we're getting started. Yep. And just a reminder, if you do have written testimony, please, you can hand it to our trusted committee staff. And for those folks who will be testifying again, I'm going to ask if you can please summarize your testimony and not read it. And Dr. Bates, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Twice in one day.
Yeah.
Everything works well. We won't be seeing each other these conditions for the next 3 weeks.
Can you pull the microphone a little bit towards you, because make sure that you can get heard. Thank you. Okay.
Are we in session? Okay. Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3 in Southern Oregon. Thank you for listening to us today. I'm looking forward to a rousing debate here today. I'm sure it will be. I'm a little concerned about time constraints, but hope that the chair would consider giving us more time next week if some of the people who are coming from a great distance.
We will make sure we hear them today.
Thank you. Because
yep.
I know people come from a long distance,
yep.
Many who support, many who do not support this bill, and I like to have all sides heard. So I appreciate that occurring. So my opening statements will be brief but rather broad. You'll hear further testimony and detail from those who will follow me, both from the Department of State Lands and from the Attorney General's office, and I'm sure from others in the audience. This bill is designed to codify a 2005 Attorney General's opinion that flowable waters of the state of Oregon are, in general terms, open to the public to the usual high water mark for commercial and recreational use. The opinion is based on decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court and the sovereignty bestowed on Oregon at the time of statehood. You will hear much more on this opinion from others who are presenting to you today. The bill is designed to produce clarity in definitions, such as what is a high water mark. We're talking about a 100-year flood or the usual high water mark and a bunch of other issues that we won't deal with right at this moment. There are definitions all through the bill which we hope spell some of that out. It'll talk about what the rights and responsibilities of both the property owners are that live on or near waterways and the users of those waterways. It'll also talk about what rights do local jurisdictions, police, counties, cities have, state agencies, and citizens groups, many of which have been formed around the state to protect these waters. We want these waters to be regulated in a safe and sane manner, and by their nature or by the needs of protection when that needs to occur. The bill is also designed to decrease the need and likelihood of the state land board declaring a waterway navigable, which results in the state taking title of the banks up to the high water mark. This is a process that is both expensive, inefficient, and litigious. Just for full disclosure, this just happened on the Rogue River about a year and a half ago, and we are still working through that. Parts of the Rogue River at statehood were a mile and a half from where that river is now, and the state has taken title of lands that are actually no longer having a river flow through them, are going to have quit claims, all kinds of work done to straighten out the issues of titling and effects on people's property who have now lost title to what they thought they owned as far as the river is concerned, down to the bank or even below the river. So one of the questions you're going to hear today is, so why now? I think there are several reasons to move this bill forward.
First, conflicts are growing on our waterways as the population of our state grows and the use of rivers and lakes increases. I've seen on the Rogue River, when I first started floating that river 40 years ago, we rarely saw another boat and no houses. As Senator Atkinson well knows, that has changed dramatically in that river, and that's not an exception in this state. These conflicts are both increasing and dangerous and can actually trigger some action amongst individuals that is quite concerning, just as we saw in the John Day a few years ago. As previously noted, this process is very, very complex. It's expensive both for the state and expensive for the landowners when navigability is declared. Second, this bill has been 10 years or more in the process. This is not a new issue. It's gone on and on and on. It's a process which in the last year, through several long and open meetings, brought owners and users alike to the table to agree to a bill in a manner not seen in the past. I will tell you also that some people feel they have been left out of this process. It was not on purpose. They were not aware of some of those meetings. I'm sure some of them are here today, and we're continuing to work with them and talk to them. You should also note that in this bill there is no emergency clause. This bill does not take effect until we're back in full session. There'll be a long time before this bill takes effect if it's moved forward and becomes law for more discussion and possible changes. In closing, I think this is an important bill for our waterways, one which allows us to take an important step in dealing with future conflicts in a thoughtful way, not waiting for the courts or an initiative to settle these issues in a draconian fashion. I appreciate, first and foremost, you being willing to listen to a very, very difficult question in this state. The old saying that water is for drinking whiskey is for drinking and water and water is for fighting is absolutely true. This has been a very interesting debate for me. I've gone back to law, including the Duke of York, when we first became a nation. It's intriguing reading if you have time for it. It does not put you to sleep. It keeps you awake at night reading it, and it's very interesting. And the different feelings and perceptions by landowners and water users in the state are still miles apart. We need to bring these people together so that they can enjoy the waterways together without having conflicts constantly occurring. I think they're only going to get worse as our population increases and people use the rivers and the lakes more. Thank you for your time.
Great, thank you. And if you could stick around, there might be a few questions. Director Soliday, do you want to go next? Or King?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm David Leith, the Associate Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. SB 1060 obviously has engendered a vigorous policy debate with respect to the relative rights of private property owners and the public with respect to the waterways of the state, potable waterways. If we were riding on a clean slate, that there's clearly strong arguments, strong interests on all sides of that policy debate. But we're not writing on a clean slate. The law with respect to public access to floatable waterways in Oregon is established by Oregon Supreme Court case law dating almost back to statehood. The 1869 case of Weiss versus Smith first established and recognized that the floatable waterways of the state are, as the court called them, public highways, and recognized a public easement to use those waterways. That case involved a log float, and the adjacent property owner sought to enjoin the float and to enjoin a boom that was related to the log float, and which would have been placed on the adjacent property owner's land abutting the river. The Oregon Supreme Court rejected the challenge and held that the public right to use the waterway allowed the float to proceed and the associated boom on the adjoining lands. So that's just all the way back to 1869, reported in the third volume of the Oregon Supreme Court Reporter. A long line of cases. It's a long and well-settled principle that's been referred to as the public use doctrine that covers the floatable waterways regardless of whether they're federally recognized as navigable such that the state would own the beds and the banks. The doctrine is discussed at length. Of course, the body of case law is in numerous Oregon Supreme Court decisions, not readily accessible. Slightly more, although perfect, not perfect, slightly more accessible is the Oregon Attorney General's 2005 opinion, which tries to distill and state in a coherent fashion the public use doctrine as distilled from that long line of Oregon.
Yeah, can I ask you to wrap up because
yes,
we are short on time?
I apologize, and I will do that. The Attorney General's perspective is that this bill accurately codifies the public use doctrine as established in the case law, and that the clarity that's provided by that codification and the accessibility to the public, the accessibility of the that's brought with codification is certainly to the benefit of the public and to and the Attorney General supports SB 1060 for that reason.
Thank you. Director Soliday?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I'll be very brief. We're the agency who is charged with doing navigability studies. As a result of that, we are the agency that gets calls from the public, both recreational users and landowners, trying to sort out what the rights of the public are with regard to using rivers. And we refer them to the 2005 Attorney General opinion, and we've done some brochures, some educational pieces to try and help explain the rights to the public, but it makes it more difficult not having the public use doctrine in statute for both the users and the landowners and for those who are trying to enforce the rules out on Oregon's rivers. We believe that if we can get these rules in place in statute, it will likely lead to less requests for navigability studies where we actually go in and determine whether the river was navigable at the time of statehood, and if it was, then we are have been the owner since 1859, and that's a very contentious process, and it's an expensive one. And if we can clarify the rules that exist under the public use doctrine and statute so that law enforcement and the courts can use those rules in working with folks when we have conflicts on rivers, I think it will work to the benefit of everybody involved in this issue and likely reduce the number of navigability studies that are requested from the department.
Okay. Louise, Director Soliday, what's the average cost of a navigability study for the department?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the actual study process costs about $50,000 from beginning to end. If we end up in litigation, which we almost always do at the end of a study process, it can cost several hundred thousand dollars more, depending on how far through the court system the case goes.
Okay. All right, questions for the panel? All right, thank you. Stick around. I'm sure there could be some questions. And we have Secretary of State Brown, former State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and then is there somebody else coming up with you, Randall? Or?
The Secretary of State.
Okay, Michael. Yes, no, we got her, but I, yes. Okay.
Thank you, Michael. Madam Chair. For the record, Kate Brown, Oregon Secretary of State. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 1060. I appreciate your time and energy. I introduced similar legislation in 2005 with my counterpart at the time, Senator Farioli, and after that session vowed never to touch this issue again. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I ended up as a member of the State Land Board, and in preparing to sit on the State Land Board, I listened and watched the testimony around prior navigability decisions and the impact that they've had on communities around Oregon. And what concerns me is the six petitions waiting in the wings. In Oregon's 150-year history, we've had, I believe, 12 rivers declared navigable, and we have about 111 left to go. I'll let Senator Atkinson do the math because he's smarter than I am in math only. And
Yeah, but he was using his iPhone to do it, I saw.
Anyway, at our current rate, it's going to take a long time before we've completed the federal navigability determination on Oregon's waterways. And I just have to say, as an Oregonian, I find this unacceptable on a couple of levels. One is that based on our Constitution, Oregonians have a fundamental right to access Oregon rivers, much like we have access to our beaches. And you, as policymakers, have an obligation to implement that right. And this, Senate Bill 1060, is the one consistent policy option that has been discussed regularly for the last decade. And secondly, and quite bluntly, navigability determinations don't really solve the problem. And Senator Bates talked about the conflict resolution. But it's like we're sitting down after dinner playing a game, and Senator Prezansky's playing Monopoly, Senator Dingfelter's playing Scrabble, and Senator Atkinson is playing Texas Hold'em. And we're all playing by different rules. And it's frankly not working. So property owners have no ability currently to keep river users from abusing their rights and no way to protect their property. Water users don't know what their rights are. And law enforcement doesn't have any ability to enforce the law because, frankly, all it is at this point is a 36-page attorney general's opinion. So I would heartily encourage the Oregon legislature to support legislation creating a management plan, happy to answer any questions, and happy to spend however much time it takes to get this matter taken care of in the near future. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I'm sure glad you didn't have me playing Texas Hold'em and doing Scrabble.
Sorry, I clearly missed the
I was going to say you should have.
Yeah.
He's the Texan, so he should have been playing it.
Game okay. of life on the end of it.
All right, Randall.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, former State Treasurer of Oregon, former Land Board member. I've been before this committee. I've been before committees just like this one to talk about our rivers and the need to bring some clarity, as you're hearing over and over and over, about what are the rights of the landowner that is along a river in the state, as well as what are the rights of those on the river, and what are they doing, what they can or cannot do. As a Land Board member, as Kate just described, the only tool right now for anybody that has a concern about access to a river and use of a river is a navigability determination. That, as you heard before, is an incredibly long, litigious process, and in the end, all you're solving or resolving is who owns the bed in the bank of the river. It doesn't resolve what you can do on that river. The bill before you, and I think you heard from the Attorney General's office, simply codifies case law and an opinion by the Attorney General over those rights, the rights of the public on the river as well as the rights of the landowner. And I know there are a number of people in this room who will tell you why there's a list of horribles, why we shouldn't do this. The fact is, the issue is never going to go away unless you have a navigability determination, in which case there's a great of interest on that river and the public around that river. This is a state issue. It's been an issue since statehood. It's time to step up and find a solution that gives landowners their knowledge of what they can and cannot do, including the liability of the public on the river. This bill gives them exemption from liability of the public on the river. It gives the recreationists some sense of what they can or cannot do when they're floating a river. And it's time, as you're hearing from Secretary Brown, we have to resolve this. It's not serving the public. It's not serving the state. And the citizens of Oregon deserve a better solution than we have today.
Thank you. You missed a practice because you just were 2 minutes. Okay, Michael.
Chair Dingfeld, yeah. Members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio with the Office of the State Treasurer and the Treasury Land Board Assistant. I'm here today to communicate Treasurer Westland's support of Senate Bill 1060. 1060, as was previously mentioned, codifies the public use doctrine simply, usually, beg your pardon.
Somebody's beeping up there, yes.
The Treasurer feels that Senate Bill 1060 is a fantastic way to clarify the public's use of the waterway without involving a navigability study, which can be a process which results in the loss of title to an adjoining landowner. What this does, and I'll just skip right to the end since the bulk of my testimony has been covered already, the Treasurer believes this creates a straightforward process to what can ordinarily be a complex and expensive process. It's a good bill, should pass, and clarifies the public's use, which is the intent of the Land Board, is the intent of the public use doctrine already, and should be the intent of the legislature, in Treasurer's opinion.
Yeah, thank you. Questions? All right. Well, I think you just moved everybody over. They don't have any questions. But stick around because there may be some. Okay, so we are now going to start taking folks off the list, and I wanted to call up first folks who have come over 100 miles. It's Leslie Pittman, Tim Josie, and Daria McMasney. Did I get that right? Okay, come on up. And as I mentioned, you have 2 minutes each. Please remember to introduce who you are, and of course you know all the rules because you've been up here gazillions times, former legislator Josie. Whoever wants to go first.
Want me to go first? Good morning or good afternoon. I'm Tim Josie, Tillamook County Commissioner, and you're right. I used to be a legislator, and I cut my teeth on this issue, and I can tell you...
How many years ago was that?
Oh, gosh. I've been a county... This is my 12th year as a county commissioner, and so I served in the legislature for 8 years. Floyd was in the legislature at the time, and Mark was a reporter. He and I don't.
Neither of them. None of us had gray hair back then either, right?
So I hope you didn't take part of my 2 minutes with that question.
All right, we'll reset. It wasn't a trick question there, really.
This was a very difficult issue. I introduced legislation and tried to because it was so contentious. We have river users and landowners going like this, and in between the middle of this is the resource, which is getting hurt. So I introduced legislation. I wasn't sure where it was going to go, but what I wanted to do was try to bring the two sides together. And I can tell you, I was born on the banks of the Wilson River on a dairy farm. My dad wouldn't speak to me for 6 months. Literally, I'm not exaggerating over this issue. And so, anyway, we had a public hearing. The room was filled. Senator Ted Ferrioli found out about my bill, and he ended up taking it away from me and created an interim committee. And I think Beth was on a roadshow that we went all over the state. And indeed, we confirmed this is a very contentious issue. You know, both sides are fighting. And so, when I became a county commissioner, oh, let me say one more thing. There was another bill that I worked on that was a success, and I used as a model when I was in the legislature. That was watershed councils. Chuck Norris, myself, and Bradbury worked and developed the language for watershed councils. This was the model that we used in Tillamook County, because watershed councils bring people together from all sides for the betterment of the resource. So what we did when I became a county commissioner was we created the Trask River Advisory Committee. And the Trask River Advisory Committee is another way of doing this. And the first thing that they did after forming was developed a Trask River stewardship model. Now, the advisory committee is made up from people from both sides of this issue, where they address the issues and collectively work through the problems. And I'll just talk about some of their goals and objectives. Produce signage maps and references, provide information on fish spawning beds, emphasize fishing etiquette, develop a river keeper program, attain restroom facilities and garbage service, publicize ways to report and follow up on river violations, so on and so forth. This is the way to do this. We don't have to go through these very long, contentious, litigious experiences that we just heard about from DSL. Each county can form these advisory models sanctioned by the county to address these issues, and those issues then do go away. And then the winners are the river users and the landowners, but more importantly, the winner is the resource.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Leslie Pittman, and I'm president of Operation Rivers Northwest Oregon, and we are here to oppose Senate Bill 1060 unless we can work on some amendments to make it more acceptable. I have included -3 amendments for your consideration in our packet. We oppose this bill because, first, we and others feel that it's being rushed through a short legislative session. And we're very concerned because affected landowners and conservation groups have not been notified or had time to respond. Second, without our -3 amendments, we have no local provision grassroots efforts for local management and stewardship plans, and we'd like the opportunity to do that. Third, this is a broad brush, one-size-fits-all statewide approach, and if our fishing regulations need to be 100 pages long to meet the uniqueness of Oregon waterways, we feel that river usage and access and all those matters need to be individual as well on a river-by-river basis. Fourth, we're very concerned because at least the versions I've seen, there's no way identified to pay for the impact that this bill will create on the Oregon waterways. And we hope that there'd be no further discussion of this bill unless a funding mechanism is provided to pay for the impact and damage to our sensitive riparian areas. Fifth, we're concerned about the codification of the AG's opinion in this bill. Our attorney and others and other organizations do not feel that it is a clear interpretation of the court cases that make up Oregon's floated easement. And lastly, fish and wildlife are depending on the waterway and the habitat for their existence. This needs to be a question of stewardship and not just a question about ownership and usage. So overall, we ask you to please not support this bill as it is written, and please consider our amendments as well as a local stewardship approach that includes communities and grassroots efforts. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for coming here today.
Hi, my name is Daria Lamasny, and this is the first time I've done this, and I really don't know the rules.
It's okay, you've got 2 minutes, and you can say whatever you want.
Here we go.
As long as it's
I reside on the North Fork of the Nehalem River. I also own property on the Trask River in Tillamook County, and my concerns about this bill and why I oppose them are as follows. The landowners really do not know or are aware of this bill and its implications. We need more time. You Google it, you'll get 22,000 items from which to choose. I feel the special interest groups are self-serving and are surreptitiously pushing this bill through. Navigability studies are not complete on all rivers. The safety of the people using the waterways, the safety of the landowners. You've got domestic animals, farm animals, and last but not least, of course, the fish. So the verbiage of this proposed bill is far too generous, open, and without boundaries, leaving the door open for abuse of private lands in a very litigious society. We have wonderful state and county parks on our rivers for recreational use, as well as boat launches and takeouts, with amenities such as restrooms, trash receptacles, and fire pits. Our state of Oregon has many gems, mountains, deserts. How about the fine planned cities we have? Let's take Portland. I do enjoy Portland with all its cultural amenities and attributes. I periodically go and enjoy these things. However, I do not expect 25 feet of someone or anyone's lawn in the West Hills to be at my whimsical access for picnicking, gazing at city lights at night, or overnight camping. I feel this, in closing, is really rushed through on that short session. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming here today. I know that you drove quite a ways. Before you leave, though, I want to see if there's any questions. You have one?
No, comment. You did a great job.
Yeah. Excellent job. Maybe some of the lobbyists can take some tips from you. Okay. Thank you very much for coming up. Senator Johnson, I know you wanted to come up. And Representative Boone, did you want to come up?
Dale? Actually, we were here with constituents who had come from Great Ways. Dale Buck has also come from Tillamook. We can meet with the committee anytime. I want to make sure others get a chance to justify.
Okay, great. So why don't we call Dale Buck? We have A. Ains. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time reading your name.
Ainsworth
and Ron Baird. And again, we'll reset 2 minutes, and if you do have written testimony, if you could just summarize for us, that would be helpful. We often need help, so. Okay, thanks for coming here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair Denfielder and members of the Senate Environmental and Natural Resource Committee. My name is Dale Buck. I live at 25590 Chinook Street in Cloverdale, Oregon. I'm a retired Tillamook County dairy farmer, and I previously owned river frontage on the Little Tillamook River. My written testimony has basically to do with the small rivers and streams. Senator Bates has really good intentions, and I'm sympathetic to Director Soliday of the DSL. This is a difficult situation, but barely anybody knows about this bill. I spent time yesterday on the Kilches and the Miami River. They're called rivers. They're really not much more than a creek, and the people were amazed that somebody would come up with a bill like this. So, number one, few people know about it. Number two, we're trying to hurry this through in a short session, and people spend time recreational activities. They're on the backyards of many of these houses that are on these smaller streams. This bill, an inflatable device, includes air mattresses, inner tubes, and anything else that'll hold air. So this makes small rivers and creeks navigable in near or flood stage when people shouldn't be in them anyway. The rest of the times they're basically rocks and sandbars, and you certainly can't make progress on those as the bill says is required. So I would like you to oppose this bill. I would like to see it graveyard dead, and then we need some careful thought and study as required before a water body is declared navigable above tidewater. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming here today.
Madam Chair, my name is Ron Bird. I am president of the Nestucca Anglers. We were established in 1999 with 300 members. We work very closely with ODF&W. We raise 100,000 fall Chinook annually, put in 2,500 hours annually on volunteer basis with ODF&W and our program. I'm here today to use a river as an example, and in the my written testimony, you have several documents there, and we'll get to those in a second. Three Rivers is an example of a river that we've been working very closely on. Under the definition of this bill, it will be classified as Class 1. And this particular river is a river that has been very near and dear to our heart for fishing opportunity. It has a Cedar Creek hatchery on it, and from Cedar Creek hatchery to the mouth, it's 2 miles. We have a mile and a half of public access. In the past history with ODF&W, they have had very limited fishing opportunities, and we started working with them to allow the public to get on this river and fish these fish for what they're used for. At that time, in 2004, we were able to get new regulations put on the river for spring Chinook, fall Chinook, and the winter steelhead. As a result of this, we have had been working with the landowners, we've been working with the public on the education, and have had little conflict in the last several years on this particular river. In 2006, ODF&W wrote a letter to DSL over the navigability study. That letter is in your packet, and this basically stated that if this river does become navigable, that they're going to have to cut back on the regulations on this river that we worked so hard for. In closing, I would like to say that we oppose this bill, just for the simple fact that this bill is blanketing all rivers, and this little river here, as you can see the pictures that I presented to you, is going to be a Class 1 on this definition. And at that time, the public will be able to go through and fish and use the private land, and which is used as the protected areas for ODF&W to protect their broodstock for the hatchery. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder and the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Al Ainsworth. I'm a founder of Northwest Rafters 28 years ago, and I've been involved in various versions of a bill similar to this one, and mostly opposed. And my comments today are very brief, my written comments. Basically, I support the framework of the bill, and I want to continue to be involved in the process. I think there's a tweak to be done here or there, and I think it'll be a workable bill. Anyway, thank you for your time, and I've floated rivers for, I'm pushing 40 years on water, and so I've been involved in a lot of issues, and I think one thing that's not emphasized in here that a lot of people have spoken to is education of the public. Art Israelson with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders did a study on different age groups and how they felt about their rights on rivers. Different age groups had different interpretations of what their rights are. And I really think we're negligent in educating the public. And I think that's got to be a strong portion of the bill.
Okay. Did you submit written testimony?
Yes.
Okay.
Very brief.
I just want to make sure that we've got it.
Have you handed it in?
Well, people were doing it afterwards, and I thought that was the time to.
Yeah, just make sure that you submit it so we can see what your suggestions are.
Anyway, I'll submit additional written testimony. This is just basically my name and address and very brief.
Well, you could email it to Beth if you could make sure, because we want to hear what your suggestions are.
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these gentlemen? Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Three quick questions for Ron. Ron, thank you for coming. When you worked with the private landowners as a protection area, essentially for Three Rivers, did under current law, private property extends to the center of Three Rivers in those places? Is that right?
The property land, the bottom of the river, is that?
Where is the property line?
Most
on the private property on Three Rivers.
There is three different big landowners that are on the river. When I say, you know, we're talking about a half a mile. One is halfway. The other one is all the way across, and I believe the third one is halfway also.
Thank you.
Across the river.
Thank you. You raise 100,000 broodstock for fall Chinook.
Mm-hmm.
How's that done? How do you do that?
How do we do that? It's a broodstock program that we, 80% of the fish are caught hook and line by volunteer fishermen. The adults are brought to the hatchery. At that time, the hatchery is, they take care of the eggs. And about April, we'll receive the fish. We have a facility called Rhodes Pond, which is an ODF&W old facility that we renovated. And we raise those fish, clip those fish, and in September, we'll release those fish in the Nestucca Basin, Three Rivers and the Nestucca Basin.
Thank you. One last question. How is the heart attack hole fishing this week?
Heart attack? Well, that one.
That proprietary information?
See a tree going all the way across it. That's kind of an obstacle when you hook the fish. The broodstock steelhead are coming in there.
You have to portage.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. You may see Senator Atkinson out on the river next week, but hopefully...
tonight.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think he's heading over there tonight. All right, thank you very much. Next up, we have Travis Williams, Tom Wolfe, and David Moskowitz. And I just want to let folks know that we are going to go until about 3:25, and then we need to vacate this hearing room for another one. And I'm going to hand over the gavel to my trusty vice chair for a minute here. Oh. Yeah.
Okay,
3:20.
Yeah. I'm doing men. What's the waiting clause on this baby? Travis, go ahead.
My name is Travis Williams, and I'm executive director of Willamette Riverkeeper, and I'll keep this very short. As to the, first of all, we support this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. We're a little concerned about the proposed Section 12 relating to the local jurisdiction. Feel that the rest of the bill without that is something that would benefit every Oregonian. And if we're talking about the previous gentleman in relation to the Nestucca with issues relating to natural resources, you can look at Section 6 of the proposed bill, and it allows ODF&W and the other agencies to consult and develop rules that would protect that resource. But I think the biggest, the reality here on the ground is that Oregon needs to protect the public trust with the public's access to these rivers, the public use doctrine. It's a very important thing. To date, the state has not done that, and it's unfortunate. This is something that could have been dealt with decades ago, and we wouldn't be having this battle now. I think in general, we focus on the few issues where you have flare-ups with landowner, conflicts with various types of river users. I think we can all acknowledge, if we're honestly looking at the situation, that in general river users and landowners have very few issues, and most often I've paddled canoes around the state and on a whole variety of rivers. People are very amicable, and you stop and talk and chat, and you move on. So to me, this, given the development behind it and the thought that's gone into it, it makes a lot of sense to pass this now so we can move on and dispense with this issue and all go out and enjoy the rivers that are out there, and also provide an additional level of protection for landowners, which I think is clearly elucidated in the bill in terms of what can happen to river users if they don't follow the rules. So to me, that's where the fairness really comes into this issue. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom?
Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee, my name is Tom Wolf. I've submitted some written comments, so I'll keep my verbal comments very brief. We also, Oregon Council Trout and Limited also supports, oh, by the way, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout and Limited, representing 2,800 members here in the state. As I spoke, we support the drive of this bill. We support SB 1060-1 amendments, but we cannot support SB 1060-1 in particular in Section 12 amendments, because just to parrot what Travis was saying, it just opens up a lot of local jurisdictions to make decisions. We feel that this should be decided statewide. We commend Secretary of State Brown, Senator Bates, the Steelheaders, and others that have been involved in the issue. We think this is time that this issue needs to be dealt with. And as Travis stated, it's part of the public use doctrine. It's something that was guaranteed to all Oregonians, all the members of the public, the right to use rivers. And since many of the rivers where you fish for salmon and steelhead are on adjacent to private land, as far as a group like Trout Unlimited is, made up entirely of fishermen, it's very important that we protect and clarify and codify their rights. Thank you.
Thank you. David?
Thank you, Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today representing Common Waters of Oregon, which is a statewide group whose mission is to protect the public's right to use Oregon's waterways. I want to state that Common Waters Oregon supports the -1 amendments of Senate Bill 1060. We have a few technical suggestions, and we will share those with the proponents and the committee administrators and your committee. Common Waters does not support the -2 amendments as offered. As previously mentioned, Section 12 allows for the creation of a patchwork of local management plans, and it's ill-defined. The planning process is ill-defined. It can result in a patchwork of different regulations or restrictions across the same river. On the Rogue or the Umpqua or the John Day, where you have multiple counties, multiple jurisdictions, we view that as very problematic. We also view it as a diminishment of the public right of use. The local management plans are not envisioned in the State Attorney General's opinion from 2005, which really defines what the fundamental right of the public is to use Oregon's waterways. And it's akin to the Oregon beaches, as Secretary of State Brown mentioned. This is a very fundamental and basic right that all citizens of Oregon enjoy, and a local management plan on the Trask can't necessarily address the fact that all Oregonians may be on that river, and not just people from Oregon, but from out of state as well. And those people who use rivers bring a huge amount of economic revenue to local communities. That's important that we look at this as a statewide basis. There have been a number of references to the state's navigability process, which is defined as being expensive and difficult. And this bill doesn't solve that. It doesn't address that. This is about the public's right to use Oregon's waterways.
Can you wrap up, please?
Certainly,
thanks.
I will. Common Waters of Oregon supports the 2005 Attorney General opinion and its broad public use right, and to leave it undiminished, Oregon's waterways are public highways, and
this bill, in the form of Dash 1 amendments, will begin to protect that right, and we do support the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, next up, Norm Ritchie, Art Israelson, and Paul Reed. Okay. Norm, you want to get started? And just remember to pull the mic towards you, please. Okay, whoever wants to get started, we're waiting, so go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Paul Reed. I am one of the members of the Executive Board of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. We have, we're in full support of the concept of establishing by code or statute the definition of public waterways up to the high water line. Our concern is related to the ability of the public to portage around the public waterways through what is turning into an ever-expanding limit or area of riparian forest buffers that are being created in accordance with the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. These programs are being funded by USDA under the Environmental Quality Incentives Program and by the USDA under the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is also co-sponsored by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and Clean Water Services of Washington County, the Bonneville Power Administration, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. To date, in the CREP program, there's been over 35,000 riparian acres, which if you translate that into a 100-foot-wide riparian area, comes to almost a half a million stream miles in the state of Oregon. And the effort to preserve and enhance riparian areas continues. To allow people to transit these riparian vegetated areas with a watercraft is tantamount to destruction of the vegetated areas that we've put in. To compound the matter, when they get to the top of this vegetated area under the CREP rules and under the EQIP rules, if you're going to have livestock on the land, you have to have a fence to separate the riparian area from the agricultural area. It's not difficult to imagine that somebody that trudges a sick watercraft up the hill to the end of the riparian area encountering a fence is going to be pretty unhappy about seeing that fence there, and there's a high perspective of damaging to that fence trying to get it over. Now, the bill does allow for a liability on the part of the user for damage that's created to the property. But I have to ask you, when's the last time somebody left a note on your windshield in your parking lot when they dinged your car door from smacking into it? It just doesn't happen. I don't see anybody leaving a note behind when they tear down somebody's fence.
Can we ask you to wrap up, please?
Okay. Additionally, the tearing down of the fence is a real problem because it'll allow livestock into the area. So we think that this bill is inappropriate for the special session, ought to go back to the sponsor to have a working group put together of the various stakeholders and come back in the regular session. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And we have your written testimony as well. Thanks.
Senator Dinkfelder and members of the committee, my name is Norm Ritchie. I'm a resident of Southeast Portland and representing the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. First, we want to thank Senator Bates and the committee for this bill. We have worked hard for over 20 years to establish fair river rights and end the unnecessary conflict. We are gratified by the Attorney General's opinion in 2005 that defined rights to access the beds and banks of Oregon's waterways and established reasonable limits of use. We were further gratified in 2008 when the Land Board passed a resolution asking the legislature to codify the attorney's opinion. Senator Bates provided Senate Bill 1060 to put into law that which has been the legal understanding for the last 5 years. It is therefore incorrect to characterize this as something altogether new. The bill leaves other issues such as ownership, fish and game management, and enforcement, and other management to the agencies that have that responsibility. The governor has stated that he will not sign the bill that does not comply with the Attorney General's opinion. It is therefore wrong to add new provisions outside the current scope. And we'd ask that you please be wary of far-out claims that you may hear here today from people who do not understand the history of this issue and what is actually being proposed today. The Northwest Steelheaders support the framework of Senate Bill 1060 and is committed to working with the legislature and stakeholders toward achieving the goal of codifying the Attorney General's opinion. And we thank the committee for the opportunity to do so.
Jason.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm just going to take a little break here to talk to
thank
another
you.
Member, but when you go ahead and get started, I'll be right back.
Go ahead.
Senator Atkins, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Art Israelson, and I'm the River Rights Director for the Northwest Steelheaders. Many of the things that you're going to hear today do not have anything to do with navigability or floatability. We believe firmly that navigability and floatability need to be separated. The handout over on the table has a history clear back to 1859 about both of these issues. The Equal Footing Doctrine gave the power of the state to hold in trust the rivers for public use. I think that we need to keep all this bill simple and uncluttered. Conflicts that landowners have with the public can be handled by DSL the same way they are on the Sandy River currently. The steelheaders are very much involved, can't get all this on at one time, with access to us. We're not asking for more access to the river, just the right to be to the high water mark. Can we focus it up higher?
She can work on it. Why don't you keep going? So okay. Because otherwise it...
Access is the high water mark only. Vegetated areas are off limits. You have no right to cross private property. Keep children and pets below the high water mark. No littering. Leave no sign of your presence. Be responsible. Participate in river cleanups. These are some of the displays that we use all over the state. We firmly believe in education, not confrontation. I just have four here. Anglers, be responsible to respect property owners' rights. And this one has to do with litter. It's in eight different languages. Pack it out. We need to remove emotion from the question of floatability. The Trask River Advisement Committee, who's going to pay for all the things that they want done on the river? And we were told just a few minutes ago that this bill is being pushed and rushed through. We've been at this now for 15 years. There has not been one single thing entered today that's new. The question about Three Rivers. Three Rivers is navigable according to the Attorney General because it is floatable. It is boated. It is still boated. The only thing that was done on that river was they stopped the fishermen from fishing out of their boats so they didn't have a conflict with the bankies. We thank you very much for your time.
Great, thank you. And just a clarification, so you're posting those signs as a voluntary program that the steelheaders are doing?
Yes.
Questions?
We participate in river cleanups. Our chapter happens to do two or three a year.
Thank you. Any questions? Many members. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, coming here and sharing your comments. Next up is Carla K. Edwards. Is that right? Bill Hoyt and Sue Marshall. Carla, why don't you get started?
Yep. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and committee members. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute as the Rural Policy Analyst. Today I'm here to strongly oppose 1060 as it encroaches Oregonians' property rights. First, in Section 1, the definition of a barrier, if you apply it to Section 7, Sub 2, actually is very broad and could impair the advancement of landowner fish restoration activities. In fact, when a landowner goes...
You may want to just step back a little bit from that because we're getting a reverb up here. Yeah.
When the landowner actually moves forward with doing fish restoration practices like root rods and riffles, this could actually impair their ability because it does create a barrier or even putting boulders in the water that has all been bona fide and usually has grant systems through the state, including such things as beaver habitat and flood erosion could actually be considered barriers because it includes the term natural or artificial. In addition, Section 7, Sub 2, in essence, provides property rights to the recreational user and yet limits the rights of the landowner. Literally, the landowner will have to consider if the proper management practices would potentially interfere with recreationists. For example, the creation of a hard crossing for livestock or fencing barrier over a waterway to keep cattle out. In fact, I could surmise that the livestock producer, for livestock producers, this could require fencing of all riparian areas if it weren't for the fact that it would be a barrier to portage for the recreationist. In conclusion, and I have other submitted written testimony, the bill summary suggests that the landowner's liabilities are limited. However, if you read the bill offers no liability protection from a person in pursuit of, and I quote, continued recreational use or personal injury, and only limited protection from habitat damage if it can be proven that the damage was caused by a recreationist and who that recreationist was that committed the damage. I encourage the committee member to not move forward this bill. There are significant issues that need to be addressed that will take time to work through.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hoyt?
My name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I am a fifth-generation rancher from the Douglas Lane County area. My family homesteaded here in 1852 and has been here since. My family was awarded the Sesquicentennial Award in the Senate chambers in February, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Cattlemen's Association and others to oppose Senate Bill 1060. There are issues that we have with private property rights that cross the lines of the intention of the bill. We don't, as a group, want to limit anybody's access to the rivers, but we want to make sure that rivers that are chosen are identified properly and the definitions used are ones that have been determined properly, and we don't think there's been enough time spent in the process to get this done. And it seems to me that listening to some of the people define what this bill was about, that they simply want to make this easy, and sometimes these decisions are not easy and there's nothing you can do to make them easy. And so when we deal with defining navigability, for instance, it's a contentious view, and I agree that it is, but it needs to be, and we need to take the time to allow the process to go forward without subjugating it and say, okay, we're going to just broad brush this and make everything okay, because we don't want to take the time to go through the contentious issues. That seems to be an abrogation, in my opinion, of the duty we have to figure out what is the best for the floaters, what is the best for the landowners. And if we simply wipe it away with a bill that doesn't really address it very well, we've created more problems than we had when we started. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Marshall.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Tualatin River Keepers. First, I'd like to thank everyone who's been involved in the hard work bringing this bill forward. We know it's a difficult issue. The Tualatin River Keepers supports the Dash 1 amendment. We think as the goal is to codify the AG's statement that this one comes closest. I would like to just briefly respond to comments about potential impact to riparian areas. The Tualatin River Keepers have worked really very hard to restore the riparian areas on the Tualatin River. The Tualatin River for many decades was so polluted, no one wanted to go on the Tualatin River. We've worked really hard, and I think there's a regional investment in the Tualatin River to gain access to the river. Access to the river, building an appreciation and a stake for the community in the improvement of this river has been critical to its restoration. We've raised over $1 million, engaged thousands of volunteers to remove garbage, plant trees, worked very closely with property owners. It's an asset to the community at this point, and I think we are happy as additional amendments and suggestions come forward to work with all individuals to make this work.
Thank you. Questions? Great. Thank you all for your testimony today. We're going to have a couple more panels, and hopefully we can fit you all in the next 10 minutes. If not, we will go over the folks who are left or folks that I know will be back next week. So is there anybody, by the way, who's here that didn't sign up that is not typically here in the Capitol that would like to come up that didn't testify? Yeah. Okay. All right, so I'll keep going down the list. Katie Fast, Roger Beyer, and John Ledger. And then next up after that is going to be, I don't know if I can fit you guys all up there, but I might. We have Dave Honeycutt, Sean Jillians, Tom Gallagher, Dave Barrows.
I had Barry Bashu with me. We both were signing
up. I didn't have you on. Oh, okay, you're on the same. Well, why don't, John, you want to just come up, or you'll be next up. Okay.
For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and the Oregon Farm Bureau opposes Senate Bill 1060. You've heard a lot today about access to the river and floating down the river, and this legislation is just codifying the 2005 Attorney General's opinion. However, it goes well beyond the 2005 Attorney General's opinion by not only addressing floating rights, but also granting the public use of the beds and banks of Oregon's waterways. The definition of public use is extremely broad. It includes water-dependent activities and incidental uses connected with those activities. That could include fishing, camping, picnicking, fires to cook, defecating, and other uses. The legislation also grants the public the ability to portage without permission above the high water mark, not only for emergencies, but also to continue the use of the waterway. This again goes beyond the AG's opinion and the case law, which only allows the use of uplands for emergencies and when a boater has lost control of his boat at no fault of his own. The bill states it protects the rights of a person engaged in farming practices, but allowing the public to access private property does not protect farmers' rights. We maintain dangerous irrigation equipment and canals along waterways. We run cows and bulls along these streams and rivers. Farmers and ranchers engage in sensitive environmental practices, which Mr. Reed with the SWCD has addressed. And we construct fences to protect the environment and our property. These fences may restrict the public's access to the beds and banks, which is blanketly allowed in this legislation. We pay thousands of dollars in fire protection fees, and public activities allowed in this legislation puts us at fire risk. There's no funding in this legislation for management and enforcement of the waterways. In remote areas that we farm and ranch and live, it's impossible for local sheriff's offices to catch those misusing private land and for us to be able to enforce a liability clause in this legislation. And I'll pass it over to Barry.
Okay.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bishu. I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I farm near Gresham. I'm here today to express Farm Bureau's opposition to Senate Bill 1060. Even by government standards, this is an aggressive and unprecedented grab of private property by the state. Oregon Farm Bureau is actively engaged in issues around navigability, floatage, and waterway and adjoining properties for a number of years. I participated in a work group that included all of the stakeholders led by then Treasurer Randall Edwards. We came as close to anyone as finding a solution. I have to be fair and say that I'm disappointed that much of the concerns of the landowners appear to be forgotten by those people. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 1060 does not contain the same balance and collaboration that past efforts have included. Landowner representatives from statewide organizations were not invited to participate in the work groups that crafted this very difficult legislation. Forgotten, I believe, in this whole process is the investment that landowners, farmers, and ranchers have made in water quality through Senate Bill 1010 and agricultural water quality management plans. We should not engage an issue this important in a special session. It appears this bill is designed more to suit the needs of the State Land Board and DSL than it is to craft good public policy that addresses the needs of property owners while allowing public use of legitimate navigable waters. The rights of landowners should never be subjugated to the costs of agencies in this manner. Senator Bates pointed to the disparate positions of property owners and recreational users. This mandate will likely serve only to further divide them. I urge you not to move this bill out of this committee.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here today representing the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, all of which are opposed to the Senate Bill 1060 and the draft dash one and two amendments. That we, those are the only versions we have seen so far. All the my members I've talked to about this bill all agree to the same thing. If this bill was simply about granting people using navigable waters permission to use other than the beds and the banks for emergency purposes and giving them liability from trespass or prosecution, I don't think there would be anyone here opposing this bill. But this bill goes much beyond that. You've heard many things. I'm not going to repeat what you've heard. There's, as many of you know who served with me in this body, I have a pet peeve about legislation that treats government differently than people. And this bill is the perfect example of that. And if you look at Section 2, Subsection 4, it says a state agency with management authority over a waterway after consultation with DSL by rule may impose restrictions in the use of the waterways between the lines of ordinary high water mark or may designate areas the public may not use. But private landowners have no ability to do that exact same thing on the exact same waterway. That is abomination, and it's completely unacceptable. If it's okay for government to restrict the use of public, why is it not okay for landowners to restrict the use of public? Of the public. The other issue specifically, and Katie Fast already talked about that, but Oregon dairy farmers are mandated to keep their cattle out of the creeks and out of the rivers. To do that, you have to construct barriers. And those barriers are fences to keep cows out, and this bill does not allow them to construct barriers. So in order to comply with one law, it would be a violation of another. Madam Chair, this bill needs a lot of work. I'd be happy to work on it. As I said, I think if you want to talk about a bill that gives people who need emergency services access to land for the purpose of those emergencies, you won't find disagreement in the landowner community. But when you go beyond that and try to take property rights, is when you get disagreements, and that's what this bill is. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. Any questions?
No, Madam Chair, I do have a comment, though.
Okay.
Very quickly, and I have to go to another hearing, but... thank you all. I have heard navigability wars since forever. I'm conflicted two ways. One, I'm an ag guy, and the other one is I have a considerable steelhead problem. Here's what I have not heard today that I really wanted to hear. I've not heard a very clear explanation why lakes are a good idea to be included in this bill, and I don't believe I've heard through all the iterations complete liability protection for landowners. Those are my two issues. I have not I'm just telling you as we go forward, those are two things that have caused me heartburn, And with that, I'm going to go serve the veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming and testifying. We actually are out of time. The folks who are left on this list, I see all reside very closely in this building. We have six people left. Are you available to come back next Tuesday? And the folks who are signed up will be able to testify first thing. I'm seeing noddings. Okay. So with that, the folks who signed up, please make sure and see Beth that you can come back on Tuesday, and we'll have it first up. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1060, close the Senate Environment Natural Resources Committee.